This evening we're continuing our overview of the New Testament book titled Acts. And here in Acts chapter 25 we find Paul. He's still under house arrest there in the port city of Caesarea. It'll help us to remember that in our study last week we learned about the day when Paul stood trial before a Roman governor named Felix. And though there was insufficient evidence to actually convict Paul, Governor Felix, he decided to leave Paul under house arrest there in Caesarea until the commander who arrested him could come and testify for or against him. Well, then at the end of chapter 24, we learn that 2 years passed by and Paul was still a prisoner there in Rome. I guess Commander Lysias never showed up. Not only that, but at the end of chapter 24, Luke also informs us there in the final verse of chapter 24, that after those 2 years passed by, Paul watched as a man named Porcius Festus succeeded Felix, and Felix, wanting to do the Jews a favor, ended up leaving Paul bound in jail. Now, just imagine for a moment. You found yourself detained and arrested simply because of some false accusation. And then after 2 years of being under house arrest, you watched the Roman ruler who could have released you from prison leaving only to be replaced by another man who has no clue about your case. What would you do? Would you stress out? Would you freak out? Would you go off? Or would you cry out to the Lord? As we consider the situation that Paul found himself in, we're going to spend our time this evening considering the way in which Paul was learning how to patiently wait on the Lord. And in light of Paul's example, we're also going to take some time to explore the importance of trusting not only in God, but also in the timing of His plan for our life. Well, with this as our focus, let's begin our examination of Acts chapter 25. If you would look with me, beginning there at verse 1, because there Luke writes, "Now, when Festus had come to the province, after 3 days he went up from Caesarea to Jerusalem. Then the high priest and the chief men of the Jews informed him against Paul, and they petitioned him, asking a favor against him, that he would summon him to Jerusalem while they lay in ambush along the road to kill him." Now, here in the opening verses of this chapter, we learn that this new Roman governor, his name was Festus, he arrived there in Caesarea, and within 3 days, he made his way to Jerusalem, and we can be certain that Festus probably advised his predecessor, Felix, to go and establish, Felix probably advised Festus to go and establish a good relationship with the religious leaders there in Jerusalem. This was the area that he would be overseeing and governing, and you better believe that they wanted to have good relationships with those religious leaders. Luke also tells us there in verse 2, that their first order of business when he arrived there in Jerusalem was all about this prisoner named Paul. It's kind of like, let's put the formalities aside and let's deal with our number one issue. And that is that Paul is still alive in house arrest there in Caesarea. Though 2 years had passed by, the high priest Ananias was quick to inquire about the status of Paul. And he wasted no time asking Festus to begin his term as governor of Judea by sending Paul back to Jerusalem so that they could ambush him and kill him. Now, as we consider the nature of this favor, and as we examine the goal that Ananias had to seek help from Festus to ambush and kill Paul, we must not fail to note that the high priest of Israel was actually attempting to pervert justice, while this uncircumcised Roman governor actually took a stand for doing what was right. As a matter of fact, let's take a moment to consider Festus' response, which is found right here in our text. If you would look with me there at verse 4. There Luke tells us that Festus answered that Paul should be kept at Caesarea and that he himself was going there shortly. "Therefore," he said, "let those who have authority among you go down with me and accuse this man to see if there is any fault in him." Now here in these verses we find this Roman ruler, he's actually taking a stand for true justice. And he did this by informing Ananias that Paul was going to receive a fair trial. He's basically saying, look, I'm not going to send him to Jerusalem so you guys can ambush and kill him. I'm not going to do that. sort of seems to me here that Festus, in his response, he was allowing Ananias to save face by kind of ignoring what he had said. He's not saying, "Oh, I thought you were a religious leader here, and you want to ambush him and kill him? What kind of religious leader are you?" He didn't take that position. He just kind of ignored what Ananias was asking for. He overlooked the request, and yet I would also point out here that the integrity of this religious leader was probably being called into question within the mind of Festus. I'm guessing that Festus is sitting there thinking, what kind of guy is this? What kind of religious leader is this high priest of Israel? Furthermore, it's my guess that Festus was quick to note that Ananias was an unrighteous religious ruler who couldn't be trusted. I'm going to guess that Festus probably came to the conclusion that I really can't take this guy at his word. I really can't believe completely what he's saying. Now, as we consider Ananias' unrighteous request, I can't help but to assume that, well, I wonder, had he grown entirely too impatient as he himself was waiting for the conclusion of this trial? We can think about how Paul may have grown impatient sitting there in prison, but I can't help but to wonder about Ananias and how he felt about it. He wanted to see Paul dead. And I'm guessing that he was stressing out for 2 years, hoping for the day when he could finally have his revenge on Paul. While you might think that a religious ruler like Ananias would have learned how to wait on the Lord's timing, he instead had become this unrighteous ruler who was willing to murder an innocent man so that he could quickly accomplish his own will. What he failed to realize is that this uncircumcised Roman governor was more committed to truth and justice than the man who was supposed to be representing the God of Israel. From this, we should take a moment to consider the way in which our witness could be quickly damaged whenever we, Christian, impatiently attempt to employ an unrighteous solution to solve an uncomfortable situation that we're attempting to control. When the Christian at work or at home or wherever, whenever we choose to engage in an unrighteous decision, whenever we employ an unrighteous solution in order to manipulate the outcome of a situation, we're causing the people around us to also wonder, what kind of person is this? I thought they were a Christian. I thought they believed in truth and justice and all the things that the Bible tells us about. From this, we should take a moment to consider the way in which our witness can be quickly damaged whenever we impatiently attempt to employ this unrighteous solution into any situation that we're trying to control. And without debate, listen, we all find ourselves dealing with all sorts of situations that we'd like to control. Truth be told, we'd like to control every situation that we're involved in, right? You know, I want my will to be done in every situation, whether I'm driving down the road or whether I'm at work or whether, you know, I'm, fifth in line at whatever burger joint I'm eating at. You know, I want to be first in line. We want to control the situation. And there are times when impatient believers will attempt to manipulate the outcome of a situation in an unrighteous way. And as we do, we cause the people around us to question us and question our faith. We must always remember that the disciple who does this, they're damaging their testimony in the eyes of those who see us setting aside our Christian convictions in order to get our way. Well, not only did Ananias damage his own reputation in the eyes of Festus, but we also find Paul, he's now establishing his credibility through patient endurance. With this in mind, if you would look with me, beginning at verse 6, because there Luke writes, "And when he had remained among them more than 10 days, he went down to Caesarea, and the next day, sitting on the judgment seat, he commanded Paul to be brought. When he had come, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood about and laid many serious complaints against Paul, which they could not prove, while he answered for himself, neither against the law of the Jews, nor against the temple, nor against Caesar have I offended in anything at all." Now here in these verses we find the religious leaders of Jerusalem. Once again, they're presenting their complaints against Paul there in the city of Caesarea. And yet, just like before, they still had no proof to support their complaints. They had no evidence to support their claims against Paul. Now, I have to admit that if I were Paul at this point in time, I'd be a little livid. You know, I'd be slightly furious that I'd been sitting in prison for 2 years, and yet no evidence had been brought against me. I'd be a little mad at this point in time, a little hot under the collar, if you will. Sitting around under house arrest in Caesarea for 2 years, all the while knowing that you weren't guilty of what you had been falsely accused of. And rather than being set free, this new Roman governor comes in and makes you stand once again before the same accusers who once again have no evidence of what they're accusing me of. I'd be upset. And yet, despite the fact that Paul had been locked up for 2 years on these trumped-up charges, the disciple of Christ here, he demonstrates great patience and trust in the Lord by simply coming and presenting his defense in a way that was very cool and calm and collected, very gentle and respectful. As a matter of fact, if you would look again there at verse 8, there Paul answers for himself by declaring, "Neither against the law of the Jews, nor against the temple, nor against Caesar, have I offended in anything at all." Now, as we consider Paul's argument that he was free from all offense, can't help but to wonder if he had maybe some amnesia there in that prison. Over the course of 2 years, had he forgotten how many people he offended throughout all the Gentile world as well as there in Jerusalem? I mean, if we go back and read through the story of Paul and his missionary journeys, it seems like everywhere he went, he was offending people. It seems like most of the cities that he went to, he was being chased out by an angry crowd because he had offended so many people with the gospel message. So what is it that he means when he says, "I have not offended anyone at all"? Well, it'll help us to understand that there are actually several Greek words which end up being translated into our English word, offense or offend. For example, it's in Galatians chapter 5, verse 11, where Paul refers to the offense of the cross. In this context, the original Greek word, it's skandalon. It refers to something that would cause others to stumble. And there should be no doubt in our minds that Paul was preaching the message of the cross, which was an offense or a stumbling stone to those who couldn't receive it. And so clearly, Paul had caused offense. He had caused a scandalon throughout all the land. Another Greek word which is translated into our English word offense, it's found in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 32. This is where Paul declares, "Give no offense, either to Jews or to the Greeks or to the church of God." This time, the Greek word is aproskopos, which was used to refer to any person who would lead others astray. And so Paul's telling the Christians there in Corinth to avoid offending people, meaning, hey guys, make sure that you're not leading anyone astray. This brings us to a third Greek word, which is translated to our English word offense. And this is the Greek word hamartano, which simply speaks of any sin which violates the law of God. This is the word that Paul was using here in our text tonight. With this in mind, notice with me again there in verse 8. There Paul declares, "Neither against the law of the Jews, nor against the temple, nor against Caesar, have I offended, hamartano, sinned in anything at all. I have not sinned in the way that they claim that I've sinned." Paul wasn't claiming to be sinless, but rather he was claiming to be innocent of the accusations that they were making against him. He's saying, hey, I haven't sinned in the way that you're claiming. I haven't sinned against the law of the Jews, I haven't sinned against the temple, and I haven't sinned against Caesar. In this sense, and with this word, he could truly insist that he had avoided the offense of sin that he was being accused of, while yet at the same time having been a person who had offended many, many people in a very scandalon sort of way. Though his accusers still had no offense to support their complaints, Paul was presenting his defense here without being overly defensive. He wasn't screaming at these people. He wasn't arguing with them. He wasn't being offensive. He's just saying, hey, these are the facts. They're claiming I did all these things. I didn't do those things. Show the evidence if you can. In this way, he didn't seem to be upset with the court. He didn't seem to be impatient with his accusers. Paul just seemed to be content that he had yet another opportunity to give his defense for his innocence. As I consider this show of content, I guess I should put it like this, as I consider the way that Paul just seemed to be content with his lot in life, I can't help but to think about something that he wrote in Philippians chapter 4. If you would hold your place here in Acts 25, turn with me to Philippians chapter 4. And as you make your way to Philippians 4, I want to remind you that the book of Philippians, which was originally written to the Christians in Philippi, this is actually one of Paul's prison epistles. And while many scholars believe that this letter was penned while he was imprisoned in Rome, I'm going to assume that the text here reveals the same attitude that Paul had there in Caesarea. But this is our focus. If you would look with me there at Philippians chapter 4, I want to begin reading at verse 11. There Paul declared, "Not that I speak in regard to need, for I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. I know how to be abased." In other words, I know how to have nothing. "And I know how to abound," or "I know how to have a lot. Everywhere and in all things I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." Now here in these verses we find this man who learned how to be content with God's will, whatever it was. If it was God's will for him to have plenty, then he was content with that. If it was God's will for him to be hungry, then he was content with that. If it was God's will for him to spend his final years in prison, he was content. He was willing to suffer in that way, according to God's will. He learned how to be content in every situation because he realized that Christ could strengthen him to accomplish whatever the Lord was calling him to do. You see, when Paul says, "I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me," he's not saying, "Hey, I can jump over, you know, a 12-story building." That's not what he's saying. He's saying, "Hey, Christ is going to strengthen me to do whatever he's calling me to do." And that's what he believed. And so he could stand before his accusers and just once more give his defense after sitting in prison for 2 years on trumped-up charges and just have the peace to know that, hey, if this is God's will for me, I'm content. And if this is where God has me, I'm content. Based on this, it seems reasonable to assume that his defense there in Caesarea was presented in this respectful way as he set out to honor his Savior. And based on this, it seems obvious to me that Paul wasn't attempting to manipulate the situation before him. He wasn't trying to control the outcome of this trial with sinful solutions. No, instead, he simply presented the truth, all the while remaining content with whatever God's sovereign plan was. In this way, I would just encourage all of us to learn how to be content with God's will, whatever it is. To learn how to just trust God in every situation, so that we might learn to avoid engaging in those sinful solutions that are designed to control the situation that we find ourselves in. Because if we aren't content with the situation that we find ourselves in, and if we don't really believe that God's going to work it out for our good, then what do? We start trying to manipulate it. We start trying to force our will upon it, and that eventually leads us to sin. So just learn how to be content. Well, after Festus heard both sides of this case, he could clearly see that Paul's accusers, they were lacking proof, and yet he still set out to appease Ananias as a good political leader. As a matter of fact, if you would look with me there at verse 9, there in Acts 25, verse 9, Luke tells us that Festus, wanting to do the Jews a favor, answered Paul and said, "Are you willing to go up to Jerusalem and there be judged before me concerning these things?" Now, here in these verses, we learn that Festus wasn't willing to do the favor that Ananias was asking for, which was to send Paul back to Jerusalem so that he could be ambushed and murdered. But he did still want to do the Jews a favor. He wanted to have a good political relationship with the people that he was leading. And so, knowing that Paul had rights as a Roman citizen, and yet still wanting to appease Ananias and have that good relationship, he went ahead and asked Paul, "Hey, Paul, are you willing to go back to Jerusalem and stand trial? I'll oversee it, but if you can just go to Jerusalem and stand trial there, that would be a wonderful thing. That would work out best for everyone, except for you, Paul. But if you could do that, that would be great, Paul." I'm going to guess that he already knew the answer to the question, though. I'm going to guess that Festus was smart enough to realize that Paul was not going to go back to Jerusalem and stand trial there before his accusers. I'm also going to guess that he was playing a political game here. I'm going to guess that he was posing this question in the ears of Ananias so that he could say, "Hey, Ananias, I tried. I did my best to get Paul back in Jerusalem, but he wasn't willing and he has rights as a Roman citizen." Well, Paul knew that there was no way that he would receive a fair trial back in Jerusalem, and so he appealed to his rights as a Roman citizen. In order to prove my point, look with me, beginning at verse 10, there Luke writes, "So Paul said, 'I stand at Caesar's judgment seat where I ought to be judged. To the Jews I have done no wrong, as you very well know. For if I am an offender or have committed anything deserving of death, I do not object to dying. But if there is nothing in these things of which these men accuse me, no one can deliver me to them. I appeal to Caesar.' Then Festus, when he had conferred with the council, answered, 'You have appealed to Caesar. To Caesar you shall go.'" Now here in these verses we find Paul, he's appealing to his rights as a Roman citizen by appealing to Caesar. And Paul was quick to point out that he wasn't opposed to being punished if he was guilty. He wasn't opposed to even being executed if he had done something deserving of execution. But he wasn't going to just sit idly by and allow the high priest of Israel to punish him for pointing people to the promised Messiah, Jesus Christ. He wasn't going to, you know, be accused falsely in this way, and he wasn't just going to sit back and let this injustice roll over him. So he appeals to Caesar. And as we consider the way in which Paul was on his way now to stand before Caesar, we must not fail to remember the promise that the Lord made concerning Paul and his ministry. Remember, it was in Acts chapter 9 when the Lord revealed that Paul was this chosen vessel who would be sent to bear the name of the Lord before Gentiles, before kings, and before the children of Israel. That was the basic outline for Paul's ministry. I should point out that this prophecy was given sometime around 34 AD, and now here it was, 25 years later. It's 25 years down the road. And while it's true that during those 25 years, Paul had proclaimed the name of the Lord to the Jews and to the Gentiles alike, he was finally now about to accomplish the final portion of this prophecy as he proclaimed the name of the Lord before kings. In order to prove my point, let's continue to make our way through our text tonight. If you would look with me there at verse 13, there Luke writes, "And after some days, King Agrippa and Bernice came to Caesarea to greet Festus." Now, it'll help us to understand that King Agrippa was the son of Herod Agrippa I. And not only that, but he was also the king of a place called Chalcis, which was a small kingdom just north of Judea. And though he wasn't the king of Judea, he was the king of this small area just north of Judea, but he had also been appointed as the curator of the temple there in Jerusalem. As such, he had developed an interest in the Jewish religion, and he was looked upon by Rome as an authority on the subject of the Jewish faith. That being the case, I'm sure that Festus was glad to bend Agrippa's ear regarding the court case between Paul and the Jews who were accusing him. And beginning there at verse 14, Luke tells us that when they had been there many days, Festus laid Paul's case before the king, saying, "There is a certain man left a prisoner by Felix, about whom the chief priests and the elders of the Jews informed me when I was in Jerusalem, asking for a judgment against him. To them I answered, 'It is not the custom of Romans to deliver any man to destruction before the accused meets the accusers face to face and has opportunity to answer for himself concerning the charge against him.' Therefore, when they had come together without any delay, the next day I sat on the judgment seat and commanded the man to be brought in. When the accusers stood up, they brought no accusation against him of such things, I suppose, but had some questions against him about their own religion and about a certain Jesus who had died, whom Paul affirmed to be alive. And because I was uncertain of such questions, I asked whether he was willing to go to Jerusalem and there be judged concerning these matters. But when Paul appealed to be reserved for the decision of Augustus, I commanded him to be kept till I could send him to Caesar. Then Agrippa said to Festus, I also would like to hear the man myself tomorrow. He said, you shall hear him. Well, here in these verses, Luke is telling us about this guy, King Agrippa, and how he was very intrigued by this case. Remember, he was the curator of the temple and very interested in the Jewish religion. And so he wanted to hear more about what Paul was saying. He wanted to know more about Jesus, who had died, and yet Paul was affirming was alive again. I'm going to guess that Festus was still a bit confused about all these things. You know, he had just come into Caesarea, and all this was kind of put in his lap. And I'm guessing that he's thinking, oh, here's King Agrippa. He's an expert on Judaism, and he could probably clear up a lot of this for me. And so he was happy to bring King Agrippa in and tell him the story. And King Agrippa was like, hey, I want to hear from the horse's mouth. I want to hear what Paul has to say. The fact is, though, we have to remember, Paul's ministry was all about reaching the Jews and the Gentiles, and according to the Lord, also kings. And now we see this being fulfilled right here in our text. As a matter of fact, look with me there at verse 23. Luke tells us that it was the next day when Agrippa and Bernice had come with great pomp and had entered the auditorium with the commanders and the prominent men of the city. At Festus' command, Paul was brought in. Now, we'll read more about what Paul says to Agrippa in our study next week. But here we find Paul being brought in before King Agrippa. And there at verse 24, Festus said, King Agrippa and all the men who are here present with us, you see this man about whom the whole assembly of the Jews petitioned me, both at Jerusalem and here, crying out that he was not fit to live any longer. But when I found that he had committed nothing deserving of death, and that he himself had appealed to Augustus, I decided to send him. I have nothing certain to write to my Lord concerning him. Therefore, I have brought him out before you, and especially before you, King Agrippa, so that after the examination has taken place, I may have something to write. For it seems to me unreasonable to send a prisoner and not to specify the charges against him. Here we find Festus just fully admitting, hey, I don't have a clue what's going on here. Can someone clear this up for me? And so he's asking King Agrippa to come in and bring his knowledge and his wisdom about Judaism and to clear this up so that he could write down the proper accusations. He was hoping that King Agrippa would clear it all up before he sent Paul to Rome to stand before Caesar. But what this means is that Paul would not only stand before King Agrippa right here in our text, and we'll read more about that next week, but we also learn that Paul was being sent to stand before the most powerful man in the entire world at this point in time. Paul was being sent to stand before Caesar. In light of this, I would point out that it took 25 years for the Lord to fulfill that vision that he gave Paul at the time of his conversion. It took 25 years for the Lord to take him to reach the Jews and the Gentiles and then finally to stand before kings. 25 years went by. And throughout that span of 25 years, Paul patiently waited upon the Lord. Paul patiently walked through every open door. Paul spent that 25 years allowing the Lord to guide him into every ministry opportunity. And based on his example, I would encourage every Christian here to learn how to be content as you patiently wait on the Lord's timing. It's such an important lesson that we can find here in our text tonight. Paul presents us with a perfect picture of a man who waited on the Lord's timing. We didn't see him 10 years into the ministry. Well, I thought you said I was going to stand before kings, and I give up. No, he continued to take every opportunity to accomplish the ministry of the Lord until the Lord fulfilled the vision that he had for Paul. In this way, we too need to learn how to wait on the timing of the Lord. This is a difficult thing to do, especially in this world where everything happens at the speed of light. Our food is fast, our mail is sent and received electronically now, and we refer to the old school way as snail mail. Snail mail, we're going to type a text real quick. You know, it's just speed of light. We need it now. our entertainment is downloaded on demand. I mean, I remember, you know, back in the 90s trying to download something. It's just kind of like wait 5 hours and later on you'll get to hear one song, you know. And now it's like 20 songs in 1 minute. This computer's so slow. We want it now. We think everything has to happen now. And we live in this world that trains us to believe that everything should be instant. Instant soup isn't fast enough for us. We've been trained to think in this way of instant gratification, that whatever I want, I should be able to get it now. I need a drone to drop off my package from Amazon. Then the Lord says, hey, I'm going to do this cool thing in your life. That's awesome, Lord. Do it now. It's like, the Lord's like, no, that's just not my plan. That's not my timing. But Lord, do it now. We have to learn to wait on His timing. And I've seen too many Christians burn out because the Lord told them something. The Lord gave them some vision. The Lord said, hey, I'm going to do this cool thing in your life. And when the Lord didn't do it the next day, they gave up. Because they had no patience to wait on the Lord's timing. I remember when the Lord told me He was going to send me to South Austin. I waited 5 years before my pastor finally sent me. 5 years. I was like, well, Lord, I thought You told me something. He did. He just didn't tell me when it was going to happen. Christian, listen, I can't even begin to tell you how many believers, and I know a number of pastors who went out, planted a church, and it didn't become a mega church overnight, so they gave up and threw in the towel. I've seen Christians start ministries, and when it didn't, you know, blossom into this, you know, incredible thing, and it was just like this ministry to a couple of people, they gave up. Well, I thought the Lord told me it was going to be like this, and, you know, after a month, it's only like this, and, you know, clearly this wasn't God's plan, and wait a minute. At what point in time did you get this knowledge of God's timing so that you know exactly, you know, how He was planning to do this thing? 25 years. Paul patiently waited for God to fulfill the vision that he had for his life. And I believe that that's a good lesson for us to learn. I know that this is an issue that most of us, if not all of us, struggle with. We hear from the Lord, we want that to happen now, and we become impatient when it doesn't happen overnight. That being the case, I just want to conclude this study with the words of James, who wisely declares, "My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. But let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing." And so with that, we can ask, Lord, give us patience and give it to us now. Let's pray.